Support for this show comes from Art Beats and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art Beats and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual past while also revealing their distinct roles within Art Beats and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art Beats and Lyrics now on Hulu. Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
For decades, milk has been fueling women marathon runners as the OG performance drink. And in the new docuseries, Running Sucks, brought to you by Team Milk, Abby Ayers takes us on a journey of self-discovery as she meets several groups of empowered women runners to find out what drives them, what fuels them, and what pushes them to go the distance. And in the process, she learns that she too can be a distance runner. You can watch the series at runningsucktheseries.com and register for the inaugural Every Woman's Marathon at everywomansmarathon.com.
Hey, it's Max. Before we get started, I want to tell you quickly about a new Kindle single. Just dropped this week. It's called Mussolini's Arctic Airship. It's written by Eva Holland. Eva is a friend of the show. She's a contributing editor at Longform, fantastic writer, and she's been working on this one for a while. So go check it out. Mussolini's Arctic Airship, Kindle single, out now. Here is the show.
Hello, and welcome to the Longform Podcast. I'm Aaron Lammer, here with my co-host, Max Linsky.
How are you, sir?
We're both from Longform. Evan Ratliff, who is absent, but we've left an open chair for him, is out this week.
Playing that ultimate.
Playing a little ultimate. We want to get this episode out quickly because it's about a story that came out in the Times Magazine last week. My guest is J. Caspian Kang, who long-time listeners show will remember from episode 35.
35?
Yeah.
Wow.
When I told Jay that it had been 4.5 years since he'd been on the show, his prediction was that it had been about a year and a half.
That's weird because I feel like Jay has lived like whole journalistic lives since then.
He has lived many journalistic lives. He was one of the people who helped get Grantland off the ground. That's what we talked about the last time he was on the show. Since then, he's worked for NewYorker.com, and then he basically the whole time has been doing features for New York Times Magazine, and he is also a correspondent for Vice News Tonight on your TV set.
But why'd you have him back now? What was the New York
Times
story?
He wrote a story for the Times Magazine. I think it's called Not My Brothers. It's about a hazing death at a Asian American fraternity from Baruch College, but it's also about Asian American identity. It's an unusual piece for the Times Magazine in how much of the writer's personal experiences are and discussion of identity. I thought it was great. It's definitely resonated very strongly with people. Like, the long form email box has gotten several emails with a request to forward them to Jay. And when I see something like that, I'm always interested in talking to someone about it. So he generously volunteered to come in here and get this up now.
I'm excited for this one. I'm also excited for Labor Day weekend.
Oh, yeah.
Because I'm going to the Decatur Book Festival with Evan. We're going to talk to a whole slew of authors that we are bringing to the Decatur Book Festival along with MailChimp. We've been reading these books all summer with the good people at MailChimp.
Give me an example.
Let's see.
How many books have you read this summer, Max?
I've read too many books. I've been not doing other things I should be doing. I'm really excited. Heather Haverleski is going to be there. I'm going to do an interview with Heather. And it's going to be great. It's going to be really fun.
It's all made possible by MailChimp, who also make this show possible, and we thank them.
Go to readthissummer.com to learn more. But for now, here's Aaron with J. Caspian Kang.
Welcome, J. Caspian Kang. Welcome back to the program.
Hey, thank you.
I was just looking. It's been about 4.5 years since you were on this show.
No way.
Yeah. You've done a lot between here and there. You have a piece out in New York Times Magazine. It's called Not My Brother. That's the print title, I believe. It had a different title online.
Yeah, I don't know. The online titles are always like SEO optimized and headline optimized, as they should be. So
yeah,
I saw the online one, which was something like what a fraternity hazing death means about Asian identity or something similar to that.
Got it. Okay. Well, that's pretty much the theme.
Yeah.
You've now summarized the article effectively. Who are you writing and doing stories for right now?
Well, I have two jobs. The first is I am a correspondent on Vice News Tonight on HBO. And that's like sort of my day job, I guess. I go to the office when I'm not traveling. And then I think the title is like writer at large for the New York Times Magazine. And the difference between, I don't know if I'm supposed to say this or not, but the difference between being the writer at large and being like a contract writer is essentially that you get an email address. And so I asked the managing editor, I was like, oh, thank you. They're like, congratulations. I was like, what happens? And they're like, you have an email address, which, you know, I think is actually very helpful journalistically to have. But I think I've used it like 3 times.
So you cover, I think your official title at Vice News Tonight is you're their civil rights reporter.
I mean, I think that was when I got hired, but we've all sort of branched out into different things. I think that if there is a large protest or something like that, that generally I would go. But
yeah,
like, I think that we, since it's a nightly news show and there's so much volume that needs to be met, I think that staying on a specific beat is pretty difficult, especially given that, like, you know, things change every day now. So sometimes they just need you to go and like stand in front of something. And so I don't feel like I'm quite on a beat in a way, but I don't know, maybe I am. I've never done that before.
And this is at least the second piece that you've done for Times Magazine that delved pretty deeply into Asian American identity.
Yeah. The first one was like, I guess it was around the time that we talked last, right? Like it was, maybe it was a little afterwards.
I feel like maybe it hadn't come out yet.
Yeah, that was like 4 years ago, so maybe it was after.
And that was about that was a piece you did about a school shooting in Oakland, California.
Yeah, it was like a nursing school that was pretty like predatory in terms of like taking recent immigrants and sort of telling them that they can get their nursing degree really quickly. Their preparation for like whatever exams in California for nursing was pretty shoddy. It was an exploitative school. And so a guy was a student at that school, Korean guy, and he walked in and after some dispute about money, he walked in and like executed a bunch of people in the classroom.
Amongst the writers that I've talked to for this show who are people of color, a lot of them have espoused like, that's actually not what I want to write about. I don't have like a strong interest in writing about the racial identity that is my own. And it seems like something that you gravitate towards. What attracted you to both of those stories?
Well, I think that like part of it is because like I didn't come up as a journalist. I came up as a fiction writer. And although it's very cliche to say, like when you're a fiction writer, you really do feel like you can only be compelled by telling like, you know, true stories. And a lot of those generate within yourself, obviously.
Yeah.
And so I think when I was in the MFA program at some point, I started out trying to write things that were much more like kind of like John Cheever-y, and that they were like about misery and
WASP-y dinner parties.
Like WASP misery in suburbia. But then I just found out like somewhere along the line that I was like basically just writing the same shit, but then the characters were like kind of raceless. You know, it's not that they were white, they were just like kind of like ciphers for something. And that I was, for whatever reason, I was very young at the time, I think I was 23. I wasn't really embracing the fact that these are clearly characters who had grown up in an Asian household. So that was like the first 6 years, I think, of my writing career that it took for me to finish that novel. And so I don't really come at things from a standpoint, I think, that someone who came up as a reporter would, in which they would be like, okay, I'm going to excise myself from this and I'm going to tell this story and it's very important for me not to leak into this. And for me, growing up, the point of writing was always just to like throw myself into whatever I wrote. And so I think that's probably why, because like it feels still vaguely weird and almost like dishonest for me not to just, you know, at some point being very open about the fact that this is also about me. But look, I'm not saying that that's a good thing necessarily. I think there's a lot of journalists who would say that's actually a very bad thing. But I've not been able to figure out how to like write in a different way. And because I did grow up Asian, because I am Korean, that I think that's probably why I end up in those stories. Sometimes I feel a bit embarrassed by it, but like it's now 7 years in and it's
well,
just like something
I mean,
to do.
This story, this most recent story, which is about a Asian American fraternity at Baruch University and a student who was killed in a hazing ritual in Pennsylvania. I'm wondering for you, when you're pitching that story, are you saying, I'm going to tell the story of this hazing ritual as a window into what it's like to be an Asian American teenager in America right now? Or is that something that comes later after you've done the reporting?
Well, I mean, this was an assignment. I don't have any great backstory on why it like inspired me when I saw like a little slug of it in like Yahoo News or something like that. But it was an assignment. But I think that the reason why, you know, I've now worked at the Times Magazine, I think, for like 7 years now. So they have a general sense of what would interest me and what I would do. So
are you on the like Asian American beat? Like, if there's a story about Asian Americans, is it like
probably,
do you have first like
probably.
A first look deal?
The only thing that I would say is that if someone else did it, unless it was like, you know, somebody who I am friends with, like Adrian or Chen or like Wesley Yang or something, that I would probably be a little angry. I'd be like, why didn't you? I was like, I thought I had first dibs on that. But
I feel like you guys are like forming like a like trash collection mafia. It's like we take all the Asian stories around these pots.
Adrian doesn't write so many of them, but somewhere between Wesley and I tend to write very similar topics. Going back to the story, it was assigned to me. I think that they probably assigned it to me because they thought that I could do something that was a little bit more thoughtful, because even when they assigned it to me, this thing had happened 2 years ago, so it wasn't like it was news, but the trial was just starting, and so they were just like, why don't you go out and check it out? And so I did. I went to all the trial stuff, and I think that it wasn't until I started talking to people in that community of kids in Queens who like grow up, they go to school in Bayside or Flushing, their schools are mostly Asian. They take the SHSAT, which is a test to get into New York City's magnet schools. And from there, they go to like Stuyvesant or Bronx Science, which are also like predominantly Asian now. And then they go off to, if they do well, they go off to like an Ivy League school or Stanford or Berkeley or something. And if they don't do so well, then they go to like Baruch, you know, like this kid. So I think that when I started talking to people in that community.
The show is sponsored by Baruch College. Just kidding.
Look, not doing well at Bronx Science is really not that bad in life, you know? I think that the people that I talked to in that community ended up sort of convincing me that there is something more that I could do about growing up in this bubble. And even within growing up in this bubble where you don't really know much of your history, where it's like, why do kids always feel the need to construct an identity when they go to college, like a racial identity when they go to college? All those things like are things that happen at some varying degree in my own life. Like I went to college in Maine and there were probably like 15 Korean kids at the school. And, you know, they all hung out together and I met them my first week in college and I was this like arrogant kid from North Carolina and I was like, I don't want to spend my entire 4 years just hanging out. And, you know, they seemed very unhappy. They're in the middle of fucking Maine. Like, you know, like like everyone's unhappy. I was like, I kind of don't want it. So then I didn't hang out with them and, you know, they got pretty pissed about it. And at some point we were playing basketball, like intramural basketball, and I was playing with my roommates and we were playing against them, the Korean American Students Association. They were pretty drunk at the time. And they like beat the, they like threw the ball at my head and like threw me against the wall and were like trying to beat me up. And I was like, what the fuck are you guys doing? Something that I hadn't really experienced before. And then they come back and they say like, look, we feel like you're really like disrespectful and like you violated the norms of like whatever Korean American Student Association culture this is. And also like, we think you're an asshole. And I was like, okay, I'm probably an asshole, but like, I don't even understand what you guys are talking about. Cause I had grown up in like North Carolina. I wasn't used to this sort of society. And so I think that moment actually, when I thought back on it, it sort of was really interesting to me that like within this story, like it seemed like there are still these violent rituals that were going on and that at the heart of it was some sort of like normalization of what this culture was going to be. Like these are the rules of the culture. Like, this is the history of the culture. This is why you should take pride in the culture.
That was all real surprise. I mean, I grew up in Berkeley.
Yeah.
And so I was aware of Asian American fraternities, but I had no conception that there was this kind of like quasi academic studying, like kind of rallying element of like people learning about these historical injustices and stuff, that was part of, like, that's not a part of most fraternity life in America.
I think it's part of most cultural fraternity life, but I think the vast majority of fraternities, they don't do that. But I think that, like, even since the article has come out, you know, people from black fraternities have reached out. A lot of people from Asian fraternities have reached out, and they've all said, yeah, this is, like, pretty, like, a lot of this resonates with me, like, because the cultural education part and also, like, sort of the strictness and the occasional violence with which that history is taught feels very familiar. So I think cultural fraternities are like that, but no, I don't know. I didn't rush a frat, so I have no idea, but I would think that the majority of like fraternities, like just plain white fraternities mostly, don't have that culture.
Hey, I'm gonna pause things here for a word from our sponsor, Blinkist. If you listen to this show, you probably love reading, and you probably don't have enough time to read everything you're interested in. Enter the Blinkist app. They have over 2,000 best-selling nonfiction books transformed into powerful packs you can read or listen to in just 15 minutes. Learn essential ideas from the best books in your field, also on subjects you never knew you loved, like productivity, business, science. With Blinkist, you can feast your mind on key ideas from nonfiction books like 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, The 4-Hour Workweek, shouts to Tim Ferriss, check out his long-form podcast, all on your way home. You're taking it in, 15 minutes a piece, more knowledge in less time. Not to mention, their team is constantly adding new titles, and the app was chosen in Google and Apple's Best of Selection for 2 years, so you know it's only going to get better. Right now, Blinkist has a special offer just for our audience. Go to Blinkist.com/longform, and you'll get a free trial or 3 months off your yearly plan when you join today. Again, that's Blinkist, Blinkist.com/longform. You'll get a free trial, 3 months off your yearly plan, and support the show. That's Blinkist, Blinkist.com/longform. You'll get a free trial or 3 months off your yearly plan. And either way, you'll be supporting the show. Thank you, Blinkist. Here is J. Caspian Kang. So when you're sort of combining your 23-year-old job and your 30-plus job in fiction and nonfiction in a story like this, there's a reporting component where you're talking to the families of these students who are on trial and sort of understanding where they came from and the kind of lives they live. And then there's a secondary component that is telling the larger story of Asian American identity in America, a personal story about yourself, and those two things have to fuse together. How do you approach that other part, that personal part, where you're not asking someone else and you're not looking for quotes? And
I just write it out. This one came in at like 7,500 words. And I think at some point in the draft, I probably had like 4,500 words of like just a personal essay about like me going to church as a kid, you know, and how my family did not really go to the Korean church, but we would go like once every 2 months or something. And that was like, you know, I would meet other Korean kids there. And you know, I don't even know how it fit in, but I just wrote it and it was very well written. Now it's all gone.
Yeah.
No, I'm kidding. So then I just write it all out and then I send it all in, and then my editor generally goes and says, okay, like this is a very interesting, nice personal essay that has nothing to do with the rest of the piece. Like, let's just cut it all out except this one paragraph, which seems to be relevant. And then I like get mad and I'm like, no, you know, like you don't understand. Like I'm trying to do this like Joan Didion thing and I just want to insert myself and have this like weird, you remember like the John Wayne essay at the beginning where she's talking about going to the movie theater in Colorado and how the wind is sweeping through the deserts. Like, that's what this is like. And they're like, no, it's really not like that. And then somewhere around like the fourth email, I give up. And then the piece comes out and I'm like, oh, they were right, you know? But like, yeah, it's that process every single time. It doesn't matter what I can be writing like a 1500 word sports column and that process will happen. So shout out to Dean Robinson. I'm sorry that that happens.
Okay. So that kind of gels with how I read a lot of your work, which is I can identify where that one leftover paragraph is.
Yeah.
So what are the qualities of the paragraph that doesn't get cut? Like, what is the stuff that does work in your opinion? If a 7,500 reminiscence about the Korean American church doesn't.
I think it's generally because I think my work tends to be somewhat polemical and like is trying to make an argument. And so I think that when the argument can be couched within some sort of personal thing, that then it gets kept. And I, you know, I have to say that it's very nice that I work at a place that allows me to try and make those like arguments. Like in this one, I feel like I make a pretty provocative argument about how Asian American identity doesn't really exist, how it's like basically just an academic idea and it's not lived within the lives of anybody who's Asian. Like, you know, you grow up, you're Korean, you're like a minority, you're not, you don't have any sort of kinship with like Indian kids, you know? And there's no cultural sharedness where you're just like, oh yeah, like, you know, like Asia, you know, like our parents, right?
Yeah.
Anyway, so I think if the personal can advance that argument, then it's kept. Yeah. And it has to be pretty direct. And all the stuff that's lost is the stuff that I feel like is like, you know, like kind of making a mood towards the point.
Yeah.
And that stuff all gets cut.
Are you going to do like a director's collection at some point that's like got all of the cut personal essays intact?
I'm almost positive that I could like do like, if I took all the personal stuff that I write that gets cut, like I would have like the first volume of, you know, like some like 7-volume Proustian thing because there's so much that's cut. And a lot of the anecdotes are the same anecdote.
You've been trying to get the church story in every story that
yeah,
you could.
Mostly because I haven't done any, like, I don't know. It's like one of those, I haven't done anything in the last 7 years except, like, work in journalism, you know?
Yeah.
And so, like, every story has to come before that because the life of a journalist is so fucking boring. Like, you don't, it always feels weird to write about because it always feels like it's so insidery. And I don't know, I find that in my own work is that like when I have to interview a journalist, I'm just like the stakes drop entirely.
Nothing more burning than interviewing journalists. Who would listen to that show?
Yeah, no. No. It's not that. It's more like if the lives of journalists, I think, as a writer, I think that it's very difficult for me to write about myself as a journalist because I think that like there wasn't really much going on in my head except like how to like write.
There's a few threads that connect that story of the school shooter to this story that I see as kind of maybe part of like a larger thing that you're writing about and thinking about. And the first and foremost one is loneliness and anger and all of the emotions that loneliness provoke. But there's also the idea you just espoused of, which is basically that there's no such thing as being Asian American. That's a construct. Yet the construct of Asian Americanness is very central to the article itself. Like, if there is no Asian Americanness, why is this hazing death in an Asian American frat notable? There's hazing deaths all the time. Why this one, not the other one? How do you navigate that and think about that? Because you're basically the foremost chronicler of Asian American identity, which you're saying isn't a real thing.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess that it has been a certain irony about stuff that I've been writing because I think even like when it came to something like Jeremy Lin, which is like the last great massive referendum on what Asian American means, like if Jeremy Lin proved anything, it's that like there is probably some sort of like very ephemeral and connection between Asians in America, but it takes somebody like Jeremy Lin to bring it out that like, you know, like me and Japanese kid, Chinese kid can all sort of be like, oh, that's our guy, you know?
Yeah.
But I actually can't think of anything other than Linsanity that did that, you know? Like, it's it. And that's why it's like sort of the seminal moment, I think, in Asian American history of the past like 20 years at least, you know? Like, probably since Vincent Chin, because like that's the only thing that bonded any of us together. Like, when the World Cup happens, I don't root for China when they were playing like a European country, you know?
Yeah.
I root for Korea and the U.S. Like, I don't root for, I actually just root against Japan, you know? So I don't know. I think that that's sort of the conflict is just like, yeah, I do write about Asian American identity a lot to mostly negate the idea that it exists. And the reason why I do that is because I think, and I think I realized this a few years after college, that the way that identity is discussed within the academy, I find to be like very dishonest. You know, I don't find the conversations around Asian identity in school, like in college, that are sort of encapsulated within a lot of Asian American studies courses to be particularly helpful to kids, but also I don't find it to be like true at all. You know, like I don't think that there is a Pan-Asian identity. I don't think that it really does help that there is any like insight that I have on Chinese culture. And I also don't think that when we talk about our own place in the country that we're particularly honest about it, you know? Like I think that we sometimes are a little bit too eager to say that we're that there's no discrimination against Asians, or we're too quick to go into like super woke, dense Tumblr mode and like talk about systems of oppression, you know? So with each piece like this, I try and just be like, okay, let me think this through for like a month or so, and then I'm just gonna put out the argument that I think, and people can take it and just do whatever they want with it.
I find your arguments very cogent, but I imagine they don't start that way. Do you have your argument in mind when you start a piece like this, or do you use the writing to kind of find your logic?
Yeah, there's another thing my editor has been telling me, which is that like when I write this monthly column for the magazine, and the first draft I put in is like four arguments at once, and they all conflict with one another. And he's like, it's clear that you thought this through while writing it. And I'm like, yep. And then he's like, can you write it with one argument? And I'm like, yep. And then I'll like try. So yeah, it's, I think that that again is like the novelist part where like you don't really know where you're going. And then you kind of are hoping that the propulsion of the writing itself will lead to something interesting. I find it to be a very, very inefficient way to do journalism, and perhaps maybe not the most journalistically sound way, because you sometimes write yourself into corners. But that's why, you know, you have editors and stuff to sort of be like, okay, this doesn't make sense. You feel like you're really stretching things here. But it's like a propulsive thing. I just remember I read like a George Saunders spoke at like Columbia when I was there for the MFA, and he said that like a short story should feel kind of like a Neil Young song. It's like kind of rattly. It's not perfect, but it's like kind of rattling towards some thing that itself is great. That really stuck in my head.
The last time I talked to you, you were at Grantland, which you helped get off the ground. Your employee number, low number, I can't remember.
Three or four.
Yeah. You left Grantland. You were at editing the New Yorker's website for a period. Left that. Do you want to comment on that?
No, I would just say that Nick Thompson, when I was hired, said, my only worry is that you'll leave after 6 months. And that's exactly how long I lasted. I don't know how he knew that. You know, in my own head, I was like, I'll stay at here. They'll have to cart me out of this building, you know, but I don't know. He knew it somehow.
I mean, they carted you out very fast.
Yeah.
Then you've been doing, and you've kind of been doing the pieces for the Times Magazine throughout.
Yeah.
And now you've been at Vice for less
over
than
a year.
Yeah.
Yeah. My year point was like July. It's like the longest I've had a job in forever. So
when, you know, you got the opportunity, hey, would you like to be involved with a TV thing, a video thing? What did you think?
Yeah, I had no interest before at all. But the year before I joined the show, I had been watching a lot of documentaries, and some of them I thought were really good. Like I was watching, especially like stuff like sort of less blank short documentaries. I really found, I was like, wow, this is really something that is a lot different than the sort of more glossy documentaries on Netflix that are mostly about musicians that I generally hate. Like I really didn't like Amy, for example, or like the Kurt Cobain one. Like those two, I was just like, okay, I don't like these because they're overproduced and they're about famous people. And I find a lot of it very enjoyable. Some of it I think is actually good, but I found a certain type of them, which I knew that I could probably go contribute to be somewhat dissatisfying, you know? Like, so I think that I probably could think of a world in which my journalistic skills and connections I've made over 7 years could get me to the point where I could work on one of these big documentaries as like a consulting writer or like a researcher or something like that. And so I realized that I just needed to learn a lot more about the actual form of making film, which I knew absolutely nothing about, and that perhaps a good way to do it would be to work on this television show that purports to make 3 to 4 minute or sometimes even 12 minute long short documentaries like every single day.
Yeah.
And
under the idea that if they're 3 or 4 minute things, you're getting a lot more reps than if you did one feature over a couple of years.
Yeah. And that like you learn, and if it sucks, you're out, you know. Yeah. The part that I didn't ever think about was being in front of the camera. And I honestly, like in my own head, I thought, okay, they're hiring me to be in front of the camera. I am terrible at this, nor do I have any desire to do it. So I'll take this job, and in 2 months they'll realize that I am miscast as this, and then I'll just be like a producer, you know? I mean, I don't know. I'm still waiting to do that. And it's not because like me saying, oh, and you know, like, and then I like became like Judy Garland or something like that. No, it's like literally I'm still waiting for them to realize that it's very hard for me to stand in front of camera and do anything. And so I, you know, but I don't know. I've, through that correspondent role, standing in front of the camera, you do stand with them while they're setting up shots. You talk to the producers who are awesome about, you know, how to tell a story in video. And the most important thing is that I've learned that for me, the writing part of it is good in the sense that I think I know how to lay out a story generally because of my journalistic past. But like, it's so collaborative. Like, why a piece is good or bad has almost nothing to do with me. You know, like it's like whether or not the producer put the DP in the right place and whether the DP really like had the right lens to get the look on this person's face at a protest, you know. And me writing lines around that, it's sort of important, I guess, but it has nothing close to doing whether or not that DP got the right shot because the producer put them in the right spot. So learning all of that has been pretty awesome.
Is that strange for you to sort of lose the auteur's role in your own work?
Yeah. I would say that my job now is to basically be like the sort of board or something on my own stories. You know, like I just sort of, I come up with a lot of the ideas, not all of them, but a lot of the ideas. I like generally say this is going to be the reporting plan. An AP who, her name is Jacqueline on our team, she's amazing. She like does a lot of the reporting. Rola K, who is the producer that I work with, like sets it up, you know, and then we bring whatever camera people we have on retainer, and then they sort of make it happen, you know. Like I write a script.
Yep.
And they like cut the piece to my script.
Yeah.
It never really makes that much sense. The editor and the producer go back and make it make sense. And then I come in, I'm like, oh, that looks great.
Yeah.
And then we're on to the next thing. And so like.
Full disclosure, one of the editors Jay works with is my wife.
Yes. Yeah.
So the way that you've described doing a lot of your stories for the Times Magazine is a pretty heavy collaboration with an editor. An editor who's like, no, I'm once again, no to the church story.
Yeah.
What's that like putting together a story in video where you don't have the total freedom to just write something new or rewrite something because you're locked to what you shot on location and stuff like that?
Well, there's no self in video. So it's been more difficult transition for me than it might have been for other journalist, just because like if I was a much more traditional journalist, that it would have made more sense that I'm only there to ask a couple questions and then let like the talents of the producer, the editor, and the DP take over, you know. And so it's been, I just feel like I use a different part of my brain, you know, and sometimes I get frustrated because I think for me the process feels lobotomized from what I would do, which was like this sort of like neurotic reflection on self through the lens of like journalism.
Yeah.
You can't really do that on TV news, on a nightly news show.
I'm just imagining
it's
like a
very
speech,
weird,
like a thought bubble coming up.
Exactly. Or like VO just being like, at this time I was reminded, and then like it goes hazy and like there's a reenactment of me in middle school. Like you can't do it.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I actually have found, at first it was really did bother me, and I would, you know, in my head I'd be like, oh, this is so dumb. But when you see the finished product and it's good, and when the piece is successful,
yeah,
I feel like much more of an emotional investment in it than I would maybe a print piece about the same subject.
Yeah.
And I think that it is really cool to like have some input into how that's made. And the thing that I can't quite figure out yet, and the thing that I don't have like the sharpest eye for, which I'm trying to develop, is like, why is it that like certain shots, you know, are able to like generate this sort of immense emotion while others don't?
How do you educate yourself in the video sphere?
I guess you watch enough stuff that works, and it's a little bit difficult because, like, you know, like I said, the stuff that really inspired me to want to do video stuff was actually these sort of less blank documentaries that are completely formless. You know,
I love the idea of you going into the first pitch meeting at Vice Deuce 9. It's just like, I'm kind of thinking of like a less blank kind
of
thing.
Yeah, exactly. There's a garlic festival, and I think we should do it about 45 minutes, and we should shoot it all on film, and it should have no plot and no central characters, but it should just be like weird footage. It'll be great. TV news is interesting because it's so compressed and you have so little time to make it that there's a formula that evolves for it. And I think I know that formula now, but I don't know how to like maximize it, if that makes any sense. Like, I know how to go from A to B to C now, but I don't quite have the language yet to make sure that it has some sort of sense of me in it, you know? And I think the best TV correspondents can do that. Like, they can sort of make it feel like their piece, where like you watch somebody on 60 Minutes and you're like, oh, of course that's that person's piece. That it, not just the VO, but the way that it's shot, the way that they're shot, it like imbues part of their personality. And I haven't quite figured out how to do that myself. I think my producer has figured out how to do that for me, but I don't know.
Well, I felt like the piece that you did a piece for Vice News Tonight about a Korean adoptee who was deported back to Korea after, basically because his adoption was improperly filled out. He was not a citizen. He committed a minor crime and was deported.
I mean, when he was a kid, he committed some major crimes.
But in terms of the you shining through, I guess the you part there felt like you had achieved a trust and intimacy with him. He was a person, a guarded person who had experienced pretty traumatic things in his life. And it did seem, particularly like in the scenes in Korea when you visited him, like he trusted you.
I'm not sure if he did or if that's just his personality.
Oh, okay.
I will say that the one thing that is difficult about television for me to, and the one thing that has been tough to adjust to, is that when you are a print journalist, you can spend a lot of time with somebody. Like, I wrote a piece about Don King, and I spent 2 weeks with Don King, you know? You can't follow Don King around for 2 weeks with television cameras. You can't ask him to sit in and adjust the lights every single time that you want to talk to him. And so it ends up being much quicker turnaround. You have much less time with the person. And as much as you want it to be a sort of relaxed conversation between two people, you're always just trying to structure it like within the A shot, you asking the question, the B shot, them answering the question, and then you move on. So it's sort of hard for me to talk to subjects sometime at that level of comfort, because like a lot of time I literally just sit down and we start.
You did a piece at Standing Rock, kind of in the like final days of the Standing Rock occupation, as people were basically being forcibly evicted from the premises. And if that was a magazine piece, I assume you would hang around and see what happened, you know, kind of let the story tell itself. How are the stakes of that different when you're doing it as a video story? And are you just like, God, I hope something happens like really quickly, like right now while the camera is on?
Well, that's interesting. I wrote a piece for Vice about Standing Rock, and I also did a video where I did two. We went there twice. So it's an interesting comparison, because I think that with the piece that I wrote, I wanted to basically say that like what is happening at Standing Rock, the coalition that is created there, which is environmentalists, Black Lives Matter activists, young socialists, whatever, that they felt very disconnected to the rest of the national conversation that was going on at the time about the election. You know, like that these are not kids who necessarily care if Hillary Clinton wins or they're all terrified of Donald Trump, but they're not like Hillary Clinton supporters. Like they're not mainstream politics people, and that we have like huge, massive disconnect has happened within the left. You can't do that in a video piece, right? And so it was great to write that. At the same time, like Standing Rock was so visually compelling, especially in the winter when we went, just sort of the, when they're ripping it down, there's like meat in puddles everywhere. Like all the tents are trashed. There's no one left except people who are like, because they have nowhere else to go. Like those are the only people who were at Standing Rock at the end, basically. All that I think is much better in video. Like maybe I'm just not a talented enough writer to like convey all that through written scene, but like, oh, you have to see it, you know? So that was the one story where I was just like, working for both mediums is really great.
We're taping this on a Monday. I think it'll be out in a couple days. The events in Charlottesville took place 2 days ago, Saturday. You've been covering protests. You wrote extended profile of the leadership of Black Lives Matter.
Leadership, because there's no leadership. But yeah, of DeRay and Netta, yeah.
You wrote an extended profile of the non-leadership of Black Lives Matter.
Yeah.
What have you learned from spending the last couple of years immersed in the world of protest, and what have you learned about what's important for journalists in that context?
I the one thing I will say is that I think that activists tend to be very, very charismatic, and that I think that it's very easy to end up being advocates for them, and that I only say that because there are times when I've felt like, you know, very compelled by a certain activist, and I've started to like question my own bourgeois shit, you know, life in which I don't do anything to help anyone except myself. And, you know, sometimes I'm just like, yeah, you know, like, and I don't know, that seems very normal to me, but it also seems like maybe it's something that people should really watch out for if they want to just go out and start covering protests. But I think the bigger, larger thing that I've learned is that I don't think that the left is, or the sort of liberal America is going to unite under one banner in this administration. I think that the Women's March was like a one-off, and that we'll never be able to recapture that sort of great energy in those numbers. And that basically the process with which every group, activist group for all time, including civil rights movement, would eventually splinter off and fight amongst one themselves and like start to sort of implode because of internal fighting. Social media and the internet has hypercharged that so quickly that the second you even announce any sort of coalition, it starts to fracture. And so I think that at its core is what I've seen at every single protest that I've gone to, is that like somebody has said something on Twitter or in a Facebook group or in like a WhatsApp group, and they're always fighting.
From the perspective of a writer, that speed that you talked about, there's already probably been a million words published about the events of Charlottesville, and we're 2 days later. It doesn't really work with the production pace of a monthly or even a weekly magazine.
Yeah.
It'd be difficult. Like, it would be difficult to write a story for next week's Times Magazine about Charlottesville and feel like you were going to be able to sync up with what was happening.
Yeah, like, the only way would be like you would have to like have grown up there, or like you're grandfather is Robert E. Lee or something like that.
Been attending that Korean church there.
Yeah. I don't know how else you would do it within a week. Yeah.
So whereas for video, it can be more immediate, but I guess I wonder what you think about distance from these events. Like, what do you feel like the pitfalls of trying to cover this stuff on a production and news cycle are?
Well, I would say that, okay, so an example is that after I went to Standing Rock the first time, we got snowed in and we had been sleeping in a tent, and we went back to Bismarck and we couldn't fly out for 2 days. And in that time—
You were sleeping in a tent, like with all the video gear and everything, and everyone was in a tent?
Yeah.
Wow.
I mean, it was fine. They had like stoves in the tent.
Tents are probably really nice.
It's pretty
now,
nice,
right?
Yeah.
I haven't camped since like 1986.
So I had to go straight to Korea because the impeachment protests were happening there.
Yeah.
So I flew from Bismarck to LA and then flew to Korea. And so I was kind of flying in blind, you know? And so I tried to learn everything that I could in a few days. and then go in and try and be like smart about it. And I don't know if I succeeded or not, but like I started to realize that my job is just to stand here and talk to people.
Yep.
And show the footage, and somebody smarter who's a producer in New York will figure out how to make it factually correct. That was a very strange experience for me, though, because like I'm, you know, like as a magazine journalist, like you're never in that position where you're sort of thinking my job is to bring this footage, which is newsworthy. But I find that we're kind of satisfying in a surprising way.
Yeah.
Like I always ask them to put me on breaking news stuff. It's a little harder because I have a kid now and it's like travel is not the easiest, but it is kind of nice to remove yourself from the process and be like, I am literally here to just ask this person, like, how does this make you feel?
Yeah.
And there's actually no better question to ask this person. Otherwise, what you're doing is you're doing this preamble where you're like, well, in 1876, so-and-so built this statue here. And like, you know, and you're doing this like sort of intellectually masturbatory thing. When really what anyone watching it wants to know is like, you go up to somebody like, how does this make you feel? They don't want you in it at all. They just want you to hold the microphone. And I've actually found that process to be really nice and like cleansing, and it gets the pieces out quickly, and I watch them and I'm like, huh, I'm not like overcome by dread and like self-loathing in this, because like all I did was ask, how does this make you feel?
Is there a talent to develop of being like, when I was started interviewing people for the show, people always said, like, act like you're stupid and you don't understand yeah. anything. Ask for explanations and all of those things. When you're doing that on video, what have you learned about being dumb as an interviewer?
I think that the questions are, because they have to be edited and because they have to go in front of somebody talking, that you have to be pretty concise in the way that you ask them. And you can't do the types of things that, like, when you're a magazine writer, as part of the question, you're kind of ingratiating yourself to them to let them know that you know what you're talking about and that
yes.
you're not an idiot, you know? You can't do that in TV, you know, because the whole preamble is, like, not necessary.
Yeah, you can't be like, your research, which I've yeah. read all of and agree with.
Exactly. Your fascinating research that you published in 1982. Yeah. Like, you can't do that. So you have to be much more direct. And when it is a difficult interview in which, like, and it is a hostile interview, then you have to be like super direct. And I don't know, I guess the way that I've tried to figure out how to make it interesting to me, where I don't feel like I'm just reading off a list of questions, is that there's one question I always ask in which I am trying to like make the person really uncomfortable, that I think cuts to the heart of why I'm interested in this particular story. So recently we did a piece that was about like how after the election, the Democratic Socialists of America and the Green Party have really been looking for black candidates to run as a way, first because there is some interest among young black people within third party, even though like the vast majority of the black population voted for Hillary Clinton over Bernie Sanders, but also because they feel like the messaging from in their last campaign was really bad in terms of race. You know, like you have Bernie like going on all the time and being like, this is more about economics. It's, you know, we need to stop being so obsessed with like identity politics. And so, you know, we talked to a young black person who is running for city council here in New York, and he's running as part of the Green Party. He's also part of the Democratic Socialists of America. And we had a great conversation. And at some point I was just like, do you feel like you're a token in all of this? You know, I don't know if that's a great question or not, but I do think it's like you kind of have to ask those types of questions because it startles them into a different sort of response. And if it works, then that's like the dramatic moment of the piece. And if it doesn't work, then the person's just like, you know, like, fuck this guy. and then you feel bad.
Going forward, what are the stories that interest you? What are the things you're tracking? Like, you had kind of this run of stories about Asian American identity that have played out over a series of years. You've spent some time in the protest world. What's the next thing for you?
Yeah, I mean, look, protests, I think I'm less interested in now for the reasons that I said before, which is I think that, like, people are just scared, but they're not, like, coming together to, like, make a big sort of show. So protests, I don't know if it's going to be the most interesting thing to cover, but I'm interested in the art world right now. Every interesting debate that I find myself sort of falling into is in the art world. Like, I was like really fascinated with that Dana Schutz debate about her painting of Emmett Till.
That was at the
open casket
the
at
Biennial.
The Whitney Biennial. Yeah, like I just found that to be so emblematic of everything that's been happening for the past 5 years, and this sort of like guilelessness with which both sides were approaching their arguments. You know, like Dana Schultz's response, I thought was like crazy. You know, she's like, "Well, I have a son, and this is more about mothers and sons." And you're like, "You can't actually think that," you know?
Yeah.
But then the manifesto that was like, "Destroy this work of art. It will never be sold. It can never generate any dollar amount for like Dana Schultz because it was built." Like, I also found that to be like really fascinating in terms of I was just like, "Destroy the work." Anyway, so I've been, the more I look into art world controversies, the more like,
it's a great place to be horrified by both sides of an argument.
It's great. And it works well for TV because, you know, you can show the thing. And also because artists are like really, really either good or terrible at talking about their own work. And like both of those are interesting.
And you're just going to keep doing magazine pieces, video stuff, kind of like full steam forward on all fronts?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, yeah, and like raising a kid, but I think that at this point it would be very difficult to go back to just do one of them. And if I did one, it would definitely be writing, but like I really enjoy like working on a team in TV. It's something I've never really done. Even when I was supposed to work on a team, like an editorial team, I like was not good at it. So I feel like I'm okay now, and it's like it's been a very like satisfying experience to like, you know, let go of a little bit of control and understand that like the people who are in charge of those decisions are like very talented and smart in a way that I am not. So it's been a good process for me to go through.
I know that this most recent piece you published with the Times Magazine resonated with a lot of Asian Americans. When you talk to a younger college-aged Asian American student, say, who has read your piece and was moved by it or, you know, inspired them in some specific way, like, what do you say to someone who wants to do what you do or something in a creative field like this?
Yeah, I used to be much more, like, I thought that I was, like, being self-deprecating about it, but I just realized I was kind of being an asshole about it, where I would just be like, my career is such an accident, and like, so I don't even really know how I did it, you know? I think I said that because I felt very uncomfortable being asked those types of questions. And so I thought it was a quick, kind of like self-deprecating way for me to answer it. But to them now, I just say, like, you have to have like one really good piece, and it has to have a lot of reporting in it, and it can't be like a throwaway essay or a think piece. Like, you should just invest all of your time in finding some part of our community which is almost never covered, so you can like literally write about almost anything.
Fishing in a stocked pond.
Yeah, like none of it's covered, so find anything, you know?
Yeah, anything except Jeremy Lin is fair game.
Literally anything except Jeremy Lin and like maybe North Korea. Yeah. You know, like, yeah, you can do any part of Asian American culture, it'll feel new, you know? And just report it out as best as you can, and like bring it to a place that is not going to make it into like a curiosity. And don't get too caught up in this sort of thing that happens to all of us, which is this sort of like, well, who am I really writing for this for? If I publish it with the New York Times, am I really writing it for a white audience? The answer is yes, you know? And you can make that choice if you would rather write it for like your own blog post or an Asian American publication. But, you know, that's the choice that you have to make. But once you have committed to writing a cultural piece for a place like The Times or The New Yorker or GQ or any of these places, you have to like sort of understand that you're not going to win a lot of those fights. But you can like try and slowly through your career like negotiate a lot of these compromises out to the point where like in 5 or 6 years you make less of them.
Thank you very much, Jay Caspian Kang.
Thank you.
That was the Long Form Podcast. Thanks very much to Jay Caspian Kang. Thanks to my co-hosts Max Linsky and the Atavist's own
Evan Ratliff. Thank you to our editor, Janelle Pfeiffer, who turned this around on very short notice. Thank you to our associate producer, Courtney Harrell. And of course, our sponsors who make this show possible, Blinkist. Get your reading in when you can fit it in with Blinkist. And MailChimp. You know who MailChimp is. You don't need to know any more about MailChimp. They're MailChimp. We'll be back next week.
Support for this show comes from Art, Beats, and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art, Beats, and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual past while also revealing their distinct roles within Art, Beats, and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art, Beats, and Lyrics now on Hulu.
Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
Why do you run? Why does anyone?
I always thought that runners loved running, and that's not the case. Most runners hate running, but they choose to do it.
In the new docuseries, Running Sucks, brought to you by Team Milk, Abby Ayers learns why women runners everywhere are driven to go the distance.
It really is about taking my power back and proving myself wrong.
Team Milk is about fueling women's performance and helping them along their marathon journeys. You can sign up now for the inaugural Every Woman's Marathon taking place in Savannah, Georgia on November 16th, 2024. Learn more and register at everywomansmarathon.com.